Welcome to Real Estate I Love It podcast. I'm Shelley Hoffman, real estate expert and community advisor. Join me and various guests who are expert in what they do, such as home inspectors, mortgage brokers, investors, wholesalers. There are so many aspects to our industry that most people are not aware of, and I'm here to help you learn about them. I'm an educator by trade, and this podcast is to educate you in the world of real estate. Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Real Estate I Love It. I got my favorite group of real estate professionals with me again today. That would be Dave Ferguson, Rob Just, Christy Brightman, Steve Ladd, and Jason Miller. But today we have a special person with us. We have George Powers from Powers Accounting and Business Services. And George is agreed to come on and answer some accounting questions for us that we often get asked and give us some clarification. So George, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why we want you to give us the answers as opposed to coming up with them ourselves?
Sure. And thank you for having me on, Shelley. It's always fun to get on and talk about some of these things. I'm with Powers Accounting Business Service. We are a full service accounting firm over in Liverpool, but I grew up in Bevo, as we talked this morning. And we deal with a lot of individuals and small businesses on various tax matters and to try to help navigate some of the craziness of the current set of tax laws that we have. So, what was your follow-up question to that?
You pretty much answered it, but I'm going to jump in with the question I get asked a lot. And that is, we're in December, we're in the holiday season. I have quite a few transactions in the works, and some people are pushing to close before December 31st. And some people are pushing to not close until after the new year. From a tax standpoint, is there any benefit, pros and cons to closing before, in 2021 in this case, or pushing to 2022?
As we sit here at this moment in time, we have to talk about the current tax rules. They are currently in Washington talking about changing a lot of them, which I just heard over the weekend may not happen, at least right now, with the current Build Back Better bill. So as we sit here and talk today, the benefits for tax purposes of closing before the end of the year are not that significant. Okay. The primary reason is the way they changed the tax laws in the last tax update. They increased the standard deduction, so more people just get a flat standard deduction, and they threw in a limitation on the taxes that can be deducted. You may have heard what they call SALT limitations. I don't know if you're familiar with the term, state and local taxes, in that individuals and married filing joint folks can have a maximum tax deduction on their itemized on their income taxes of $10,000 cap. Can't go more than that. So what we find in this area is that most married filing joint folks actually do not itemize. That's for even if they own a home an entire year. So closing at the end of the year doesn't have much of an advantage. A single person may, because they have the same $10,000 limitation, but have a lower standard deduction that they have to, the hurdle they have to overcome to take advantage of that. And that's $12,000. So it is possible that closing before the end of the year could get a little bit of a boost, because when you close on a house, you are paying your taxes in advance. So you'd be paying basically at this point in time, 6 months of school tax and 12 months of county tax, that if you close, depending on where before the end of the year, you might pay all of that in advance, and that would factor into your taxes. But if you have a lot of income tax, you might already be capped out on your $10,000. So that might not make much of a difference. The other in this area, we don't see as much as maybe some other areas, is points. Points on a mortgage when you close on a house, an initial purchase of a house, those points are prepaid interest and they may be deductible as well. But we don't see a lot of points in this area in today's market as we once did. So there's really not a huge amount of advantages. Typically, I'm not saying all the time, but typically there's not a huge advantage for closing before the end of the year.
Okay. Is there anything else? I get asked a lot. Is there anything else that's a write-off, like closing cost-wise or moving expenses? Anything else that people could ever take advantage of as far as purchasing a house and moving?
Typically not. Again, with the last tax reform, they've really made a lot of changes. Moving expenses are not deductible for most people. Only if you're in the military is that potentially deductible. The closing costs, the only thing that's deductible on closing costs are actually, like I said, the points, the prepaid interest. Other than that, nothing is deductible on a home. Many times, like I said, the taxes are not deductible. So you actually have a choice is to use those taxes as a deduction or increase your cost basis. So some people are just using those as an increase in cost basis these days. But again, that doesn't usually have much of an impact on home ownership because most of the time home ownership is tax-free when you sell it also. So the tax advantages of a married couple owning a home these days have been diminished dramatically with the tax law changes. Now, like I said, the Build Back Better bill that's in Washington right now does increase the SALT limitation from 10,000 to 80,000. If they did that, we'd be back up again and a lot more people would be able to itemize once again. It's still going to be somewhat limited because of the higher standard deduction, but we have high enough property taxes around here with property and income taxes. It's not uncommon. Actually, it's more normal that many people pay $10,000 a year in taxes. In real estate taxes. You put that in and combined with income tax, that's going to be a big boost to the ability to itemize taxes if they go and do change that SALT limitation.
That might be the closest thing I've heard to a positive thing about having high real estate taxes in,
right.
in New York.
Right.
So, and I know some of Jay and Christy, you guys had some questions as well. So Jay, I'm going to throw it over to you.
George, would that be on the SALT or everything? When that proposed tax bill changes, is that going to be retroactive to a certain date, to your knowledge?
We don't know. They usually like to retroactive those things. And usually what they do is they'll pass them in like January or February and make them retroactive for the entire year prior. So there's a good chance it will be retroactive, yes.
Gotcha. So a guy that would be trying to plan to, say, sell some stocks or do some, you know, different things to beat that, it may not help anyway.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Congress in the last couple of years have really messed with our tax planning. And the words that have to be used a lot is as the rules as we understand them right now. Because they could change tomorrow, and they did that up to us until March of last year. They were changing the previous year's taxes. So it is unfortunately the standard operating procedures for tax rules these days.
And then one other thing I heard is that in the proposed tax bill, in the past, I can't remember when it was, but they had a rule in there where if you were not eligible to contribute to a Roth, or if you had an IRA, you could convert it to a Roth, pay the taxes, and then move forward. I heard something about that they were going to do away with that as well. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. The last tax bill, they started to talk about doing away with what they call the backwards Roth. They tried to stop that.
Okay.
I don't know if that's what they're talking about in this one, but that was if you make over a married filing couple joint making over about 200,000, I think singles are just a little over 100,000. You cannot actually contribute to a Roth directly, but you can contribute to a non-deductible IRA and roll it over into a Roth. It's what we call a backwards Roth. Mm-hmm. And they were going to stop that, but they didn't. So. That may be what they're talking about now. I hadn't heard this. I quite frankly only pay a little bit of attention when they talk about new tax bills, because they talk about so many things that I don't really pay a tremendous amount of attention, just the highlights, until it comes out and the president's going to sign it, because they make so many changes from one day to the next. You go crazy trying to get too many details on those things.
Yeah, makes sense. And then the one other thing I think I'd mentioned briefly was, is there, and again, it may be specific to each person, but is there benefits for somebody saying, hey, I owe a school tax bill and I have not yet paid that. I'm going to push that and pay it in 2022. Or I have a county tax bill coming up in January. I want to prepay that in 2021. Are there any advantages or disadvantages, or is that too open-ended?
That's the old tax planning tools that we used to use before the Tax Cut and Jobs Act passed, the current tax law. Where we say, you know, pay your taxes before December 31st and get a deduction this year. Or sometimes we would do bunching. We say, okay, pay your county taxes in December this year, and next year don't pay them next December, pay them in the following January. So you're bunching your taxes into a year. People would do the same thing with charitable contributions. That used to be something that people would do to in order to maximize their deductions. With the current tax law, it doesn't really make much of a difference typically, because again, we have that $10,000 SALT limitation. So what you're really just doing is just not being able to do more. And in fact, this year, I might encourage people to not pay them in December, to pay them in January, because there's a maybe possible, we'll see if it ever happens, they might increase the SALT limitation next year. Again, we don't know if it's going to be next year or last year, but we know what it is right now. You know, and all we can do is take our best guess with the current set of rules, unfortunately. Okay. So to answer your question, it is case by case, but usually there's not a big advantage. If you're a single person and you have a decent amount of interest on your mortgage, or if you have a decent amount of charitable contributions, that extra property tax to get you up to that $10,000 max may make a difference for a single person. It just doesn't seem to have a lot of impact for married folks.
Okay, thank you.
And the reason for that is, real quickly, is a standard deduction for married folks is just over $25,000. With a $10,000 SALT limitation, that means you have to have close to $15,000 in charitable contributions and interest on a mortgage in order to itemize. And if you figure a $200,000 mortgage at today's rates of about 3% is about $5,800, $6,000 a year in interest. You're not even halfway there. So you got to have someone who gives a fair amount more to charitable organizations or has a much larger house in order to get that limitation these days.
Okay, makes sense.
Christy, I know you had a question for George as well.
Yeah, I actually had a couple, because one came up in my brain as I was sitting here listening to all of that. I guess let's start with more practical one for all the people who see this. There's been a bunch of people in the course of 2021, didn't see it that much in 2020, but definitely in 2021, who are either taking from their retirement to put down a very large down payment or to make the house more affordable, because when all is said and done, you've got houses that are going for way more than they should right now, in my humble opinion. And then you've also got parents who are taking out of their retirement accounts with their kids to then give them the cash to be able to, which Rob clearly knows this as well, to give them the cash to put more money down, or again, have that smaller mortgage payment, whatever the case may be, just be more competitive for every deal. So I actually had somebody ask about their potential tax consequences, and I was like, well, I'm pretty sure there could be some.
Oh, yes.
Right? Like, definitely on the retirement side. But then there's also the gift question, right? We have parents who are giving cash to kids, whether they're expecting to get it back or not. I don't know. We don't ask, because the less we know about that sort of stuff, the kind of happier we are.
Right.
As long as it's there when we close, we're good. But I was wondering if you could speak to those kind of two separate scenarios, because I realized that me taking out of my retirement to put money down is very different than my mom and dad taking money out of their retirement to give to me to then put down on a house.
Yes. And you've got a lot of different questions there, because you've got financial planning issues there, which would defer to the financial planners here. But my general feeling, and I'm not a fan of debt, but I also think taking money out of your retirement to pay down on a mortgage is in some ways cutting your own throat. I don't encourage that. Because we got a 3% mortgage rate or less these days. It's almost free money. And investments are making, what are they making, Rob, these days? 6-8%. So you're taking money away from what would be making 6-8% to save a 3% interest rate. That the numbers alone there don't make a lot of sense. Then you start adding what potential taxes are to that. Now, you can take $10,000 out of an IRA for first-time home buying, which means if you haven't bought a home in 2 years, if you haven't owned a home in 2 years, you can take $10,000 out of an IRA. It's not 401k or anything else. An IRA, you can take $10,000 out of an IRA with no penalty. So you don't pay a 10% penalty, but you still pay income taxes on it. So you could be paying, let's say if you're in the 22% federal bracket, a 6% state. For simplicity, let's round it to 25% tax. You take out 10 grand, you get 7,500 bucks. Wait a minute. Again, let's go back to what's the interest rate on this. You're paying, and if you are taking more money out than that, you're going to pay a penalty. You could be paying up to as much as 40% tax on money from an early distribution of retirement plan. So taking money out of a retirement plan as an early distribution to buy anything is typically terrible, terrible, and particularly a house, because the mortgage rates are so low these days. And if you have to buy a house that big, maybe you shouldn't buy a house that big. That's my financial planning side. That's not the real estate side. But I like the idea of paying down debt. I think low debt is a wonderful thing to do. But taking money out of a retirement plan, and if parents are taking it out of the retirement plan, then wait a minute, they're much closer to retiring. How many years are they going to have to put off retiring in order to take money out to gift it to their children? Now, gifting it, if the parents have the money and they wish to gift it to their parents, what a wonderful thing to do. But if they have to take it out of the retirement plan to do so, they obviously don't probably have enough spare cash to be able to be doing that without having an impact on them. Once again, we come about what are you doing for your long term, for your short term gain, I guess is some of that.
Plus, George, I'll just add real quick, is if the parents are doing that, typically they're probably in a higher tax bracket than
they could
their
be
children.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be even higher taxes to use for the mortgage. So,
yeah. So it's a nice idea, but in practice, I've seen it done many, many times. A number of times where people have taken money out of retirement plan to do an addition or buy a house because they didn't want a mortgage, and they ended up with a $30,000, $40,000 tax bill they weren't expecting. And it's like, well, that just cost you a lot of money.
I think it's good for people to hear that, because what we see on the real estate side, and to Christy's point, is there's that appraisal gap. I mean, Jay, you know this as well from being with the mortgages. If a house doesn't appraise, sellers right now are looking for the buyer to come up with the additional money. Where's the buyer getting that money from? A lot of times that's where the parents say, well, we don't want you to lose the home. If the house doesn't appraise and the mortgage can't be given for, the $175,000, if it can only be given at $150,000, we'll come up with the $25,000 difference. And that's what we saw in 2021 that we've never really seen before. So this information is good, because as parents, we want to help our kids. We want them to be happy. But I think the kids need to understand the risk that the parents are taking financially for themselves.
It's a big cost. So, now, Christy, you also said the question about gifts. Gifting is not a big deal anymore. Most of the time, right now, there's for 2021, one person can gift another person $15,000 with no reporting requirements at all. So if you had married parents giving to married kids, you could give 30 plus another 30. They can gift $60,000. With no impact on having to file any paperwork. But technically they can actually gift more than that and still not have any gift tax for either the giver or the receiver. But we get into a lot of complexities there, so I don't want to get too far into it. So the simplicity part of it is that one person can give another person $15,000 in cash with no tax ramifications to that.
What if it's significantly more? Because in a lot of Shelley's context, right, we'll say $50,000 is the appraisal gap, or plus cash down.
We'd have to go back to the idea: is it two parents giving to two kids? Easy to do, because one person can give 30, and the other person can give 30. You got 60. But if that's not that, you can actually still end up gifting more. You can average it out over 5 years, and you can actually gift way more than that if you sometimes have to file a gift tax return. There's no taxes associated with that. It's just paperwork. Mm-hmm. But if it's over certain thresholds, you might have to file some paperwork showing that you've gifted more than that. Right now, the way the current rules are, again, you can gift up to $5 million with no tax ramifications if you do the paperwork right.
Oh. So wow. Basically, Christy,
I think it's 10 now, isn't it, Rob? I think it's 10 now.
Yeah. 10. So basically what happens is, At death, you can pass, I think it's like 11.02 million tax-free. Back in the old days, 10 years ago, it was 600,000. So now you know, someone dies, they can pass to their non-spouse $11 million. So what happens is if you gift more than that $15,000, which next year's going
16,
more than that, it just drops that $11 million back on the tail end when you pass.
Right.
So
right.
There's no, as George said, there's no taxes. If you gift more than 16 next year, then you have to file a gift tax return, but there's not going to be any taxes.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, the other thing that parents do is they, you know, they'll sell some investments to generate cash to gift to their children for the mm-hmm. closing. What's mm-hmm. better to do is gift the investments in kind as stock, mutual funds, have the kids sell them because probably the kids are in a lower tax bracket.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, capital gains, the kids may even be zero tax bracket for capital gains. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so you may want to just advise the parents before you sell it to give to your, you know, your children, you know, check with the accountant, check to see, you know, the difference in the tax rates for the children.
And that's excellent advice there, Rob, is that with a capital, people don't understand that when you gift an asset, you gift everything about it, including its cost basis. So if the kids are not making a lot of money, if you gift a stock that has some gain in it, like I said, they might be a 0% capital gain on the federal level. So they might not pay any taxes on that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Who else in our group or did George, did you answer all of Christy's questions that she threw at you? Did that list go in?
all of those were answered. I have my like weedsy wonkier, like more for later.
All right, Steve, you said you had something for him.
Yeah, I actually have something. So George, with the number of people over the last 2 years who have changed the way that they work, and primarily the location in which they work. So a lot of people now either on their own through their own organization that they've set up or for an employer are working from their home. And I have seen in the past where, you know, depending on how the organization is set up, so if it's your own like S Corp or your own LLC, or you're just working as a sole proprietor DBA, if you're doing any one of those things and you have a designated spot within the house that you say, look, this is where I work from. This is my office. I don't have another location to go to. Therefore, this 10 by 10 or 10 by 12 portion of my home theoretically is my office space, which, so to speak, belongs to my business by virtue of lease or what have you. How complex is it to get into deducting? And are you deducting from a personal level, or are you deducting off of the sort of gains that the business is producing over the course of the year? How does that work?
Great question. And it really depends on the situation of the person. Like I said, let me answer the easy one first. As an employee, and this also changed in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, in that as an employee, there is no longer a home office deduction. Employees can no longer deduct home office. It's just gone. Poof, no longer. It's that simple. However, if you are in business for yourself and you are a sole proprietorship, and a sole proprietorship is you're filing your business taxes with your personal taxes, it's all on the same tax return. If you have an area of your home that you use regularly and exclusively for that business, yes, you may be able to take a home office deduction, and you take a percentage of your home. Let's say that you use 15% of your house for business, you get to take that percentage of your interest on your mortgage, real estate taxes, insurance, maybe some general upkeep, you can take as a deduction on your business. If you're a corporation, corporations don't have homes. There's no such thing as a home office deduction if you're an S Corp. So you have to do it a little differently. So you can no longer take a home office deduction, but remember that you're an employee of the S Corp in that case. And as an employee, your expenses can be reimbursed by your employer. So if you're an S Corp, you can submit an expense reimbursement request to your employer for the cost of insurance and real estate taxes and homeowners insurance on your portion of your home office. So you can get reimbursed for those expenses from your S Corp and do it that way. And also don't forget that if you have a home office deduction, all the expenses associated with it inside that office. So let's say that you paint the office and put up shelves. Those are not home office deductions expenses. Those are office and business expenses. So you got to kind of separate some direct expenses and some indirect. The indirect is what most people talk about when they talk about home office deduction, a percentage of the interest, a percentage of the real estate taxes, a percentage of the homeowners insurance, things like that. But really the big thing with home office deduction is actually not those expenses. They're good. Take them if they've got them. The main reason you actually want a home office is because from the moment you step out the front door, you're now on business mileage. And the bigger deduction, if you have a home office, is actually the auto deduction, the mileage.
Right. No. Yeah, that's true.
That's a good question.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Okay. Yes.
All right, before we go back to Christy with her wonky questions, as she put it, Dave, Rob, Jay, do you guys have anything else for George?
Yeah, I do. I'm curious about the capital gains aspect of a real estate transaction. I'm in the process of closing this week on a commercial property. Huh? And curious as to just what I'm looking at in terms of handovers to the government.
You mean selling or selling or buying?
Okay. Selling.
Yeah. Yeah, selling rates, what you have to do, you said you've got commercial property.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's mixed use.
And you didn't mix the use, you didn't live in half? And
no.
Okay. Because that change, obviously home capital gains changes is completely different. When it comes to capital gain rates, you have, if you've owned it for more than a year, and I'm assuming you have, you sell it, you're going to pay up to, let's just call it 20, up to potentially 20%, but usually it's probably 0 to 15% capital gains rates for the federal, plus about another 6 for New York State. So odds are you'll be paying about 21% tax on the gain, the economic gain of the sale of that property. If you've depreciated it, you have to also recapture that depreciation up to a potential maximum of 25% capital gains rate. It won't go over your income. It'd be income tax raised to a maximum of 25. So it's a bit confusing, but in essence, let's talk about, for simplicity, probably about 21% tax you'll probably pay on the gains.
And are the expenses that were put into the property over the course of owning it also applied against that gain? If I put it
Did it that way, it should have been basis. So, for example, if you put a new roof on it, you depreciated that roof, that would be part of your cost basis of that property. Yes. So that would go against it. So what you paid for plus the closing costs at that time, plus any improvements to the property, and then you also take off your closing costs of your, remember I said with personal doesn't make much of a difference on closing costs, with commercial it does. Different set of rules. So all the closing costs add to your basis. And then when you sell, any commissions that you're paying or any other closing costs come off of the sale price. So you really only pay taxes on the amount of money you gained. So if you started with $100,000 and you walked away with $130,000, you basically pay taxes on the $30,000. In the end, we get back to all the tax law is really all of what it does is it changes timing. But we're all trying to get back to pay taxes on the income you made.
Right. But in that scenario, if it was 100 grand and you made 130, but the 30 is then deducted for 20 grand that you put in the building or 4 years, you're paying on 10.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yep. And you got to, by the way, on a tip on closing costs, when you sell a piece of property, if you're looking at the, I used to love the old HUD statements. They're still on there a little bit, but they're not required anymore. And it can be frustrating, but that's a different issue. But as you're looking through and you see it more with commercial, is if you see commissions for the buying and selling agent and they're different and they have to be different by the deposit, that means that the selling agent has kept the deposit, offset it against commissions and lowered their invoice. That's actually commission. So don't miss that. What is sometimes listed on the closing statement as a deposit of X and may get, you got to do the math. It may be actually a commission, which would be part of your closing costs and not pay taxes on. So you got to go back to the idea. Show me the money. How much money are you getting? Go back to that.
Thank you.
I quote that movie a lot when it comes to taxes. Show me the money.
Yeah.
Shelly, I think you're muted.
Thank you, George. I was just saying, Jason or Rob, any other questions for George before we throw it to Christy?
I don't think so. I mean, no, again, it's all speculation, but nothing in there about proposing changes for like home equity interest deduction, anything like that.
I hadn't seen anything in that. As you guys may know, that was the big change they made a few years ago, is that the $100,000 of, we don't care what you spent it on, as long as the mortgage is on the house, you can deduct that. They did away with that also in the Tax Cuts and Job Act. And now you can only deduct interest on a new purchase or renovation of a home. So the refinancing of mortgages to pay off like credit card debt, that debt is not deductible technically anymore. And no, I've not heard where they've changed that or changing that, Jason.
Okay.
I just have a real quick one. Last year, I think it was the first CARES Act in March of last year, there was the provision where you could, take a withdrawal from your 401k.
Yes.
Basically a COVID hardship withdrawal. And you could, bypass and not have the 10% penalty. And the nice thing is you could spread the income over 3 years. Now, maybe. that ran out December of 2020. Do you know if that had been lengthened or is still in effect for some this year or?
Well, the taking the money out and spreading it over 3 years is not in effect, but right. Having to pay taxes on it, you say it's a nice thing and it is, but it's not always going to be nice. And we're going to have a lot of people this year. They're going to be surprised and not be happy on tax time because you've got the second third of that third. So if right. You took out, let's just say $90,000 out of a retirement account, because of COVID, and you said, I'm going to spread the tax over 3 years. Well, a lot of times that $90,000 that came out had withholding on it. So you took one third last year and you put it in the income taxes, no penalty, but you had to pay income taxes on it. Well, you had withholding on that. So the taxes weren't too bad last year. This year, you're going to get $30,000 with no withholding.
No withholding, correct.
So people are going to pay a lot of taxes. But by the way, anybody who's listening out there, you can pay that back. So that $30,000 can be paid back up until filing of April 18th this year. You can pay that back and not pay income taxes on that. So if that was a temporary thing that you thought you needed the money, maybe you didn't. If you can come up with some cash to pay that back, pay your retirement money back. Because I hate to see people robbing their retirement because then you don't get to retire. You get to work forever. So if you can put that money back, you get to save the taxes on it and it can go back into your retirement portfolio. And you can do things like Rob will tell you what the investments have done this year. If you didn't have your money in investments this year, you were out a lot. The last 2 years they've done amazingly well. So you do have opportunity to do a nice tax deduction this year if you took that money out last year and put it back.
Thank you. All right, Christy, what you got for us? Oh, Christy left us.
And we just left the show. Why don't you push the wrong button? Why don't you mention hit unmute? And she accidentally
she would have the ability to hit the StreamYard link and come back, and there she is.
Apparently nothing. So my kind of, there were actually two that came up, but the one that I had originally thought of was one of the main documents that we always have sellers sign, and Dave may have attempted to have you sign one for your closing, is a 1099, right? Yep. A certification that says this is my primary residence, two out of the last five, less than 250 or 500 if we're married, no business purpose, which is actually interesting getting to Steve's home office thing, right? I don't know if that will bounce you out of a 1099 now and then you'd have to declare part of it or something. When we're talking about getting away from having to pay capital gains on your home, right? And on your principal residence, the IRS is happy to cut you a break and say, we encourage home ownership. Please continue to do that. So any gains you make, if you fall into those requirements, we're not going to tax. So we can go back to the home office question. But the one that I actually had was, we see a decent amount of entities or trusts set up for benefits of people, whether it's they're trying to deal with Medicare, Medicaid planning, or they just don't want the personal liability, whatever the case may be, and there is somebody who lives there as their primary residence. So a trust is probably the best example, right? I set up a trust and put my house into it. I live there, right? So I get all the tax, real estate tax benefits of it. You can claim all my exemptions. But when I go to sit down and fill out that 1099, the trustee is Shelley, but she didn't live there. So who's filling out that 1099? Is it Shelley as the trustee because she's actually the transferor? Or is it based on me as the person who settled the trust and lives there?
It would actually be the trust.
So the trust doesn't exist, though, for my purposes, because it's not really a thing.
Well, it would depend on the kind of trust you have. If you have a trust that is created in your will, yeah, the trust doesn't exist at that point in time. But a lot of times people that are putting houses into the trusts do exist. They have been created. And one of the if you have a newer trust, some of the older trusts operate a little bit differently, but the newer trusts, you got to look at what kind of trust it is. If it's a grantor style trust, and we're talking about getting a little wonky. Now we're getting there. Depending on the kind of trust you have, most of the benefits and liabilities pass through to the person who owns it, which is a trust, which is a grantor, which is, let's say it's mom and dad put their house in the trust. Most of that passes back to them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now there is an exception if you gift the house, the residence to your kids and then retain life use, completely different set of rules and gets very complex. And people sometimes you do that as they figure a simple way of planning and it ends up being incredibly tax complex. It's not simple. So that's not something that should be jumped into quickly because that life use thing is not a simple transaction when dealing with taxes. So, my best advice on that, Christy, is typically the 1099 is going to go to the trust, but the trust many times doesn't have a tax ID number. So it has to go to the social security number of the grantors, which is typically said mom and dad, what we just say in this case. I'm not sure if that answered the question or just screwed it up even more.
No, it does. You're basically, it's essentially the trust itself, which would be the trustee filling it out, which means it's not exempt, right? It's never going to hit it if the trust itself is filling it out because the trust doesn't live there, really.
Well, again, so we're talking about trust taxes. So
right.
Many times you would still get the exemption for that. Hmm. You know, again, different for life use. There's all kinds of different things.
Oh, life uses. Oh boy.
Life use is a problem. So you don't want to sell a life. You don't want to sell a home with a life use until the person with a life use actually passes away. I'll give you that.
We're seeing a decent number of life uses go away, mostly because the person who has the life use is getting ready and they want to shift to a different place. They don't want to be in that home anymore. They want to.
And I'll just give a highlight on that. The kids get to pay income taxes in that case.
Yeah, we kind of. Figure that out, which isn't great for them.
No.
We might need a whole show, Christy, on life use and taxes and trust. And
yes, I agree on that one. That's a whole
tons of people have done. I don't know if it was like a, you know, like I'm sure in each of our separate professional pockets, like there's these little spurts of like where everybody's like, oh, this is a great idea. Let's do this. So there's a bunch of them that we're seeing at least around here. Probably, you know, half a dozen, which is more than last year, definitely by a long shot, that people have sold and they've retained life uses. So they're still alive and just relinquishing that life use. But yeah, we could probably have a full conversation on that.
It is complex. I do recommend that if anybody's thinking of doing a life use or a trust, you talk with an elder law attorney.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a specialty that not all attorneys know all the details of, but it's very complex. There's a lot to it. And what's that? And you should be talking to someone like that before you jump into something. And it's not always the cheapest way. It's not always the cheapest in the long run.
Yeah, I actually, I'm starting to have that conversation with someone. So I'll see if she's willing to come on and have a conversation with that. Because I'm hoping she's an expert because that's who I'm talking to about it. So.
Yeah. Is it an elder law attorney?
She focuses in on that, on trusts and
you should definitely have her on because she would be very interesting to discuss on a lot of that kind of stuff for you guys. There's a lot to that.
Okay. Well, thank you, George. Any other questions for George while we have his total attention on us? You know, I like to take advantage of that stuff. So
I think the only other thing I had was in the home office context, which a lot of people are doing. So Steve's question is great. You said exclusively, right? That the area can be used exclusively for that. Yeah. What does that word mean? Literally exclusively? Like I couldn't walk into somebody else's home office and use it to, you know, look up the Syracuse.
Well, it's really more of what they're saying is you can't use your kitchen table for eating and for that. Now, there are a lot of court cases in what does exclusive use mean, but pretty much it means if you've got a spare bedroom and you use it for that. Now, if the kid walks in once in a while to look up something on your Google, okay, that's not going to kill it. But if it is a place that, okay, the kids do their homework, the spouse does some work there, and then you do your work too, no, that's not exclusive use. Mm-hmm. If it's just here or there, that's not going to be a problem. We could get much more into detail on that, what it means. Doesn't mean that walking through it doesn't hurt it, but using it for something else could.
So George, I have a tendency to go in my head to funny scenarios. And I'm just thinking that I'm not married, so this is not a real life scenario for me. But if I got mad at my spouse and I slept in my office down the road, now my office is in my house. So I sleep at my office.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, if it's a one-time matter, I guess we wouldn't worry about it. Yeah. But if you have to put a bed there because it happens a lot, yeah, you might just mess up the
a different kind of attorney. So
yes, a different kind of attorney.
And again, I'm single, so that's not an issue. But you know, you always hear, so my husband slept at the office the other night, or he went to the gym. So when you said that, I thought, I wonder how that would work in that case, if the third bedroom that's not being used technically became the office, therefore, you know. So, well, George, again, I thank you. I mean, this was great information. You know, we bounce around these issues when we talk, but none of us, we don't have the expertise to answer them. So, and perfect timing with Dave closing on a commercial property as well, because you want to make sure that you're paying the least amount of taxes and obviously being upfront with, you know, how much money you actually made as well. So, all right. Well, unless anybody has something else for George, I guess we'll wrap it up for today.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
A lot of fun.
Thanks for coming, George.
Appreciate
Thanks,
your time.
George. Appreciate you.
Everybody have a great week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this week's episode of Real Estate I Love It. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review on whatever stream platform you're using for your podcast. See you next time.